Greetings, and welcome to Mind Matters News. Today, we're wrapping up our interview with Hal Philip, inventor of the modern touchscreen. In the previous two parts, we've talked about Hal's inventions that culminated in his revolutionary touchscreen, as well as its aftermath. This week, we'll cover some of the lessons Hal has learned over his career and take questions from our live audience. As a reminder, this interview is also available in video form on our YouTube channel. Without further ado, here's Hal Philip, your host, Robert J. Marks, and Bradley Norris, director of the Technology Entrepreneurship Program at Baylor University. Enjoy!
So what's the vision now?
I'm retired.
Well, let me enter fiction land then for a moment.
Yeah.
If you were going to continue working, continue inventing, would it be back as the solo inventor, licensor?
That's a tough one. You know, it is a lot of fun. You get so much euphoria out of doing that. But it's also a bit manic depressive too. You have some really great times, really great successes. The eureka moments come and you're flying high, and you do a license agreement, you're really flying high, and then somebody, you know, steals your patent and it's like you're down in the cellar, you know?
Yeah.
So it's really a roller coaster ride, and in shark infested waters as well. Would I do it again? That's really tough. That's really, I don't know. It's hard to second guess.
Yeah.
I tell people, don't try this at home. No, it's a very dangerous game. I did it because I was ignorant of the dangers. Honestly, I had no idea, no way to predict it would be this dangerous and this stressful.
Mm-hmm.
And if I had known, I probably would have said no. I'll just get a day job.
Right.
Yeah.
This kind of may be a good time to transition to
sure.
Recommendations. I think it'd be very interesting, particularly since we have some young potential entrepreneurs in the room, as well as some experienced entrepreneurs in the room.
Yeah.
What advice would you be giving to, especially engineers who are considering it? What guidance would you give them, maybe to protect them from these moments, this stress?
I will tell you, just a little footnote on that. In engineering at universities, we teach people to go to work for Boeing, Motorola, Tektronix. We don't teach them about the possibility of entrepreneurism.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
hopefully, you know, we can put something together which emphasizes that
Absolutely.
A little bit more, because that's just not an option. So I think your advice is going to be very useful.
Yeah. You know, I think if I were to do it over again, I would probably get a little more assistance. I would probably associate with a larger organization in some fashion and cut a deal.
Okay.
So size matters in this business. So if you're a large corporate, you get respect and they're not so likely to cheat. That being said, I don't know if any of you know, but the name iPhone was stolen from Cisco. That's
really?
How ballsy these guys are. Absolutely. iPhone was a VoIP phone from Cisco.
VoIP, I'm not sure.
VoIP, voice over IP.
Oh, okay.
And they just decided to steal the name. And let the chips fall where they may. And apparently Steve Jobs did a deal with Cisco and secured the name finally. I don't know how much you paid her. I think it's all a private settlement. But, you know, even being big is not a guarantee. But it's certainly helpful, and certainly in terms of financial backing. So being affiliated with a larger organization that has a little bit of moxie, a little bit of presence in the marketplace, and financial backing is useful. Getting VC backing might be useful too, but then you give up a lot of your company. You know, so it's a balancing act, right? So which do you want to do?
What about co-founders? Maybe having a team instead of an individual.
Sure, that could be helpful, yeah. Co-founders, but then, you know, if you're going to build a team, I mean, the classic Silicon Valley route is you get a team together and get VC money.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a step function capability and financial backing. So that's really not a bad route, and that's why people do that. But in the context of what I did, you have to understand that I just wanted to be a solo operator. I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to have a company. I didn't want to have a team. I didn't want any of these things. I just wanted to be able to go to the Bahamas, go on vacation, okay, and have a nice life. And it didn't work out that way. But that was my whole mindset, and that's why I went down that path. And I sort of organically fell into this path that went down this road of ending up setting up a company in England and then getting involved in all this stuff. And yeah, it is what it is, you know. So it wasn't necessarily optimal, but it's my particular story. And
okay.
Yeah, I wouldn't necessarily advise it for other people, but
it, looks like it's having a happy ending here, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Hal lived happily ever after, right? After the story is over.
Mostly.
Mostly. Okay.
Mostly.
Okay. Any other thoughts, Bradley?
No. Wonderful stories. And I appreciate in particular the story of patents licensing and being bought out. So thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
Yeah, one other dark side is your experience with trolls.
Oh, yeah.
People would call him up, recognize he was rich, and say, you violated my patent, and I'm going to take you to court unless you pay me money. Some of these are just nuisances.
I had one in particular. It was the guy used to be patent counsel for Texas Instruments, and he went to a little company called Nartron in Michigan, and he was a professional patent troll. He had a deal with his law firm where the law firm would collect a percentage of the action of whatever he could shake down from companies. And he shook down General Electric to the tune of maybe $5 or $6 million. They just paid the money. He accused them of violating his patents. He had some very old capacitive patents. Didn't affect anything that I was doing, certainly. And he just filed a lawsuit against General Electric. And they just had the policy of just paying people off. No protest, just paid them off. I knew this guy. He was kind of an operator in the business. And then he came to me. And he said, you're violating my patents. It was a complete tosh. It was rubbish. And I decided to fight him. So, again, his business model, he was in Michigan. He was in, Grand Rapids, Michigan, I think it was. Yeah, thank you. I've been out of the States too long. His law firm was in Detroit or something. But anyway, the lawsuits were all being done in Michigan. And the law firm had its own expenses to pay, and that's it. So there was almost no out-of-pocket for these guys. So the company, Nartron, didn't really have to pay the law firm anything to do these lawsuits. It was a joint venture between these two organizations, the company and the law firm. So that was the Achilles heel. So all I had to find was whether this company, Nartron, was selling product in Pennsylvania, because I had a base in Pennsylvania. And a law firm in Pennsylvania at that time. And indeed, he had sold to an Army depot some technology, something recently at that time, so in Pennsylvania. So I had found that out through something in the press. So I had my Pittsburgh law firm file suit against Nartron preemptively before he could file a suit against. He had been threatening to file a suit for like several weeks. That gave me the basis to file a countersuit even before he filed his primary suit. And I did it in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is the town where I grew up. And they fought that tooth and nail because suddenly they would have to hire a Pittsburgh law firm and pay money to a law firm. That's not their business model. And they could potentially lose. So that's a very aggressive move to try to get them out of their home turf. And in fact, he screamed uncle at the end of the day because he knew he would lose the case because they had no basis for the lawsuit. It was just a shakedown. He was just expecting me to pay money. And so we settled. And that was that. He went away.
He went away. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, with Bradley's permission, if anybody has any questions that they'd like to ask Hal, we can open it up for Q&A. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure.
One of the things, Hal is here from Switzerland. He's still suffering from jet lag a little bit, right?
A little bit,
doing okay?
If I'm talking gibberish, it's...
It's a fascinating story, isn't it? Just fascinating. So if anybody has any questions, now would be a good time to think about it. Do you have any regrets? I think one of the things you said, you created a generation of zombies or something.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, yeah, I do say that. I think it is true. It's true that without the touchscreen, you would have no iPhone. It simply wouldn't exist.
Yeah.
They would have had to find some other technology. The technology at the time were resistive, where you're pressing two layers into each other, an overlaying plastic layer with micro dot spacers into an underlying layer, indium tin oxide matrix, yeah. But it wasn't interpolative, so it didn't give you essentially infinite resolution, and certainly no multi-touch. So doing it from underside a piece of glass was totally novel. It was only my technology that could do that. And so without that, you wouldn't have the phones that you have today. Eventually, somebody would have done it, sure. But and to his credit, Steve Jobs was a visionary, and he's the one who put this together. And I owe him a huge debt of gratitude because even though he stole everything, he actually gave it recognition for what it was and made my company worth a lot of money because everybody knew where the iPhone came from, really, where the key technology came from. And I was recognized for that throughout the industry. Everybody knew. I'd been talking to all of them for years, including Nokia and RIM in Canada, BlackBerry, who rejected the technology, by the way. So you know what happened to them. So it made my company grow and have the valuation it did. Now, could it have been worth more? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It could have been worth a lot more had they dealt with my company honestly. But nevertheless, the result was very satisfying. I'm pretty happy. You know, I could have done a lot worse. If he hadn't stolen it or done anything with it, then my company would just continue to grow. Yeah, nice exponential ramp. And I would not have exited so soon. But you also wouldn't have the iPhone, which is a key piece of technology for the 21st century.
No social media or minimal social media.
Well, there's that too. So the App Store and all the social, everything, you know, it has created a generation of zombies, as we all know. People texting across the table from each other, you know, to each other. It's a little bit sad, quite honestly. I think it's removed a lot of direct personal interaction. This is quite sad.
We have a question.
I'd love if you could generalize a little bit more about your thoughts on the patent system and any possible reforms. The standard story that we teach when we analyze innovation is that there's some unfortunate consequences of patenting models. What we usually focus on is the fact that for the duration of that patent, the patent holder has a monopoly on the technology, can charge monopoly prices, earn monopoly profits. The way we explain this is, well, there's a trade-off. We have to issue these temporary legal monopolies to induce people to invent things. And that on balance, having the kind of patent system like we have in the U.S., most Western countries, you know, increases the amount of useful and valuable innovation that we get in society. From reading many accounts of how the patent system works in practice, including some of your stories today, you know, that standard story seems less and less obvious given that companies, in particular large companies, are using technologies that they find to be valuable, whether they're patented or not.
Yeah.
That the outcome of patent litigation depends on all kinds of factors other than the underlying merits. The patent trolling, you know, people talk about patent thickets and the inability to bring useful innovations to market because there are so many, they could infringe on so many potential patent holders' rights. You know, would we be better off in a world with no patent law whatsoever or with a different kind of patent law from the one that we have today?
So I haven't thought too deeply about that subject, but it is a really interesting subject and worthy of further analysis. I think the patent system we have today is actually pretty good. It doesn't really protect small inventors like myself, but overall it certainly does foster development and innovation. There's a profit incentive to have something innovative and to have that monopoly. I think that's good. Patent pools are interesting. You know, in the handset business, for example, patents are typically pooled into collections, which are then licensed and so on. So there are free market approaches to making the technology more universally available. And among large corporates, patents are typically used to defend their own product lines, but also as a means of bartering. So big corporates will barter patents with other corporates. So I've got these 6 patents that you want, and you got 10 patents that I want, and so let's do a deal.
Right, but does that lead to over-patenting? Patenting simply to have a large portfolio you can use in bargaining rather than patenting to be able to bring things to market?
Yeah, I think there is abuse like that, absolutely. I've seen a lot of patents which are just not worth the paper they're printed on. But then the court system has to sort it out, and again, that's a very expensive proposition.
Yeah.
Or if you think a patent is very weak, you just violate it. You know, I mean, the standard approach So in dealing with people with other patents that you want is you try to knock them out, right? So you find some prior art, maybe the examiner missed that in the examination process, and you feel like you have a very strong position to go ahead and utilize that patent, not contractually, but just use it and then let the chips fall where they may. And Apple certainly tried to knock out my claims. They didn't succeed, so... There is a process for all these things. Is it perfect? No. I can't think of a better approach than what we have currently today. Some things could be streamlined. The patent examination process, to my mind, is too long.
Yeah.
You know, 3 years to get a patent is just way unacceptable. You know, it should be 1 year max. And it's not terribly expensive to get a patent, but if you're going to get global patents, that is a very expensive proposition, of course, for a small company. What else could you improve? I don't know what else you could really do. I mean, maybe some things in the civil, you know, in the civil litigation process could be streamlined. Maybe cutting short some of the appeals processes so these things don't drag out for decades. That could be improved. Discovery, I've heard, was improved recently. Somebody told me that. I'm not familiar with the details, but I understand that discovery has been cut back quite substantially. So that's also helpful for small entrepreneurs. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Great. Anything else? You know, another thing that Apple stole. Okay, backstory. I asked my class, graduate class in electrical engineering, if they knew who Paul McCartney was. Half of them didn't know. Okay. So Paul McCartney was a member of the Beatles. And one of the things the Beatles did is they founded their own record label, which was Apple, which was taken by Steve Jobs. And there was a big litigation between the Beatles' Apple and Steve Jobs' Apple, who owned that trademark. And I forget the outcome, but, you know, it was an ugly thing. So This goes into the history of just people taking other people's things if they can.
So, shark-infested waters.
Shark-infested waters.
Seriously.
Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
What I'm most curious about right now is the different levels of dependence versus independence that you can approach the entrepreneurship life with. For example, do you just, you know, there's from the complete independence, it's you in your garage, you know, you got some ideas and you're contracting and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And the opposite end of the spectrum is, you know, you're working a 9-to-5 with a company that you don't really get to keep any of the intellectual property that you end up coming up with. It all gets transferred over. So I imagine somewhere in there, there's an optimal middle ground. Let's say you make a small company and spin it off before, like spin it off in the growth period or something like that. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on kind of the middle ground there, or what would be an optimal spot?
I think if you're starting out as I did, you need to find your footing and, you know, to get comfortable with operating solo. A middle ground could consist of, Bradley, as you mentioned, having a small team or something like that, having co-venturers in this process and keeping it small and lean. That could be a middle ground. I think that's a very useful way to go about it, just to have some other people with you. And if you have a really great idea and the patent looks pretty solid, certainly go for some outside money to support the company. So again, I was completely a bootstrap operation, and that's tough. That's really tough. I was fortunate because I had previous license agreements which paid me money, so I would not be on the street with a shopping cart under a bridge. But but on the other hand, it still was pretty tight, and I had to manage the money very, very carefully. There are stress points you have to avoid, and operating completely solo will give you a lot of stress for sure if you play this game. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about patent strategy? You mentioned that you got a singular patent. We just brought up the idea of patent thickets. I appreciate that. And I know a lot of the startups we're working with end up applying for a wide variety of patents to establish some white space in the patent literature.
Yeah, sure.
To create a lot of layers of protection.
Sure.
Would you do that?
Ring fencing. I did that.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, ring fencing is a very valid approach. And you could say it's a thicket and some of the patents are very weak, but that's the way the game is played. You know, so the more patents you have, the stronger your defensive position is in case you're attacked, for sure. Because your opposition now knows they have to knock out just not just your primary patent, but all these other secondary patents that relate to the application of that primary patent. So it's a valid defensive position to take. And I did that in my company, absolutely.
Okay.
We did a lot of application type patents, not just on the core technology, but
right.
application patents.
Right.
So that's the ring fencing part, to create the moat that prevents direct attack on everything else that you have.
Wonderful.
So for a small business, if you can afford the patents, I think that's a legitimate thing to do, and I would not change that system.
Yeah, I guess the larger, I mean, you know, from a societal point of view,
sure.
If we subtract off all of the expense, legal fees,
sure.
Opportunity costs of time involved
sure.
In strategic maneuvering to protect our IP, you know, somehow we have to subtract that from the benefits of the innovation that's induced by the IP. The net impact may be smaller than what, you know, an intro textbook on patenting would suggest.
Yeah.
The net societal impact may be smaller. So you're talking about, you know, you could reduce the amount of, you know, why 17 years, make it 10 years or 8 years or why not 30 years? I mean, there's all kinds of things that you
It's arbitrary. Work. It used to be 17 years from grant and now it's 20 years from filing. So that's a differential of 3 years,
but
which was the typical.
Yeah. Theory doesn't tell us what those numbers and what those starting points should be.
It's really hard to change because on an international basis, other countries would have to change as well. Yeah, you have to be pretty uniform globally to make the patent system really work.
What about countries like China, which de facto seem to be operating by a different set of rules?
Yeah, it's really hard to enforce anything in China.
Yeah.
It's really super hard. I mean, you can, but...
Right, but Chinese companies are still innovating, it seems like.
Sure. Yeah, they are. Of course, you know, theft is legendary in China.
Yeah.
My company never had that problem with Chinese businesses, but it is supposed to happen quite a lot.
Did you license to Communist China?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, we never did.
So.
No. Did Korean and...
Korean.
Yeah.
So Pacific Rim.
Pacific sort of. Rim.
Okay.
Mostly they were American companies and some European companies.
Okay, great. Additional questions, Bradley?
No, thank you.
Yeah, we've been talking to Hal Philip, maybe one of the greatest inventors of the 20th century. He's given us things such as the automatic door opener, the automatic faucet detector, and the technology that we use daily, which has included the touchscreen that we all use. Really remarkable stuff. And we appreciate your time and your effort. And I've been joined by Bradley Norris, who's the Director of Technical Entrepreneurship at the Baylor Business School. And I think it's been a very fruitful time. And thanks for sharing your venture. I mean, it's just extraordinary. When are we going to see the movie? I think, don't you think his story would make a great movie? I really
Please.
Do.
Who's going to play him in the movie?
Well, I've known Hal for a long time, so I want to be played by Ryan Gosling. So so you need to arrange that. Who do you want to be played by?
I'm not interested, sorry.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And so until we meet again, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.